As we ended in Acts 14:7, there was a note that we didn't have time for that I didn't want to give you today. And the note involves a fellow by the name of Sir William Ramsay. Anybody ever hear him, Sir William Ramsay? Okay, Ray has, and maybe another one or two. Ramsay lived a long time ago, and maybe that's why some people today are not familiar with him. He was born in 1851. He lived until 1939. Now, a lot of times, a historical character like that, you think, well, so much time has gone by, he's not too significant. That's not really the case with Ramsay. Ramsay was an archaeologist, and even now archaeologists are sometimes pretty helpful, pretty important, but he was also a Bible skeptic. Now, Ramsay had the idea, because of his background, he was also a university professor. He had the idea that if I can go over to the land of Israel, I obviously am too late in history to check out the miracles. I mean, if you weren't there, then you can't obviously say, okay, I saw this and this is my understanding of it. But he did think that the book of Acts was full of errors. So it was his intention to go to the area of Israel, and especially as he looked at the book of Acts, he thought that Luke was basically way out there, that his book was full of errors. So he travels over to Asia Minor. Couldn't get that out this morning. Got that finally. Asia Minor, to come back and show people that Luke's record was completely unreliable. Well, guess what? He goes over, he starts checking things out like we find in Acts chapter 14. There's this city, and there's that city, and there was this person who lived, and there was this person who was a ruler at this particular time. And he goes from skeptic to believer. When we come to the book of Acts and we start going through places like Acts chapter 14, you think, wow, this is tedious stuff. I really don't like geography. I really don't like to read all about these historical characters. And maybe that's true. I know that for me, that's certainly not on my top 10 list. But God did put that in Scripture for a reason, and that was very, very helpful. Ramsay came back and concluded that Luke was really a first-class historian. So today, when people are skeptical about the Bible, there are a lot of different ways that we can go to show that Scripture is reliable. And this is one of those ways, to go back and show just how reliable, just how accurate Luke was. With that in mind, let's pick up with Acts chapter 14 and verse 8. You probably have a map you can see in there. I didn't bring one up with me, but up towards the top, you will be able to find Lystra. And it's at Lystra that there is this fellow, a certain man, and he's sick. Acts 14:8 says that he was impotent in his feet, he was a cripple from his mother's womb, and he was someone who had never walked. Anybody know who else was from Lystra? It was an important community for a couple of reasons. If we skip over just a couple pages, we can find Acts chapter 16 and verse 1. And he came also to Derbe and to Lystra, and behold, a certain disciple was there named who?
Timothy.
Now, Timothy becomes important a little bit later, but he was also from Lystra, this place where Paul and Barnabas were at this time. We don't know exactly how old Timothy was when we come over to Acts chapter 14 and verse 8. Some have suggested that he was probably a teenager at this time. I think that's about as good a suggestion as any, maybe between the ages of 15 and 18. This is Paul's first recorded visit to Lystra, but it was not going to be his only recorded visit. We also find that he's going to come back to this town, this community, this city, on his second missionary journey. And then it's during that second visit, Acts 16 verses 1 through 5, that he enlists Timothy to start working with him. Then as we look at Paul's third missionary journey, Acts chapter 18 and verse 23, he's coming back to this town again. If you want to study anything about the life of Paul, Lystra is one of the items, one of the places that you do want to include. As we start looking through Acts chapter 14, we're going to find that Paul, his work in this area, there are three different responses to it. Number one, there's going to be this fellow, verses 8 through 10, where we've started. He's going to have a response to the gospel. After we get through with him, we're going to find that there was a crowd that saw this miracle. Acts chapter 14, verses 11 through 18. The crowd has a response to this miracle. Then as we get a little further down, we're going to find that there was a third response from God's people, from Christians. Luke describes a certain man who sat. Now that might not be the most significant point in the world, but it's described with the imperfect tense, that is, ongoing action. You can imagine that if you have someone who is suffering a serious health issue, they're probably going to do a lot of sitting. You have someone who's sick, someone who has just been released from the hospital, they're not going to be going out and doing their normal activities. So here's this fella, he's a cripple, he's never walked, he has been ill as far as this problem from his mother's womb. So when it comes to his day-to-day life, his day-to-day activities, he is sitting. That may be important for this reason. If you had a fella, and there probably were some miracles that met this condition, but if you had a fella who had previously walked, and now he's saying, well, I can't walk, and Paul comes along and heals him, what might the people have been able to say about that? I walked for 25 years. Last five have not been able to get up out of the chair. And he starts moving again. What could you say about that? All right, you might say that it's a fake. We find people that will fake an accident. They're perfectly healthy. They're in an accident of some type. And then they begin to, oh, I can't walk. I need my cane. I can't get up out of the bed. Anybody ever do that when it comes to an accident? Sure they do. Right?
Let me say, a fake, you know, he may have just been on the lazy side.
There is that, and there's no doubt about that. But this fella, he has never walked, been a cripple from his mother's womb. There is no question that he's ill. And if you're able to undo that immediately and fully, what's that say about you? All right, there's power that is somehow being radiated through you. There's power that's coming through you. So this is a case which was not something that any doctor, any human doctor, could take care of. A couple of the things here I think that are noteworthy. That word that is translated, never walked, we find that word being used in some other parts of the New Testament. Some of those other places are especially significant. Remember over there in Matthew chapter 7, verse 22? Jesus said he's going to talk to some people at the end of time. Those are going to be the people who are going to say, Lord, Lord, did we not do this and this and this? And they're expecting to be received into heaven. What did Jesus say in Matthew 7, 22 and 23 about these people? I never knew you. Well, somebody just says, well, you know, look, Jesus wasn't on the best of terms with them for a little while. No. When Luke says in Acts chapter 14, this guy never walked, what does that mean?
Never.
There was never a step. So when Jesus uses that same word back in Matthew chapter 7 and verse 23, I never knew you, what does he mean there? There was never a moment after you became accountable for your actions. There was never a moment when we were connected spiritually. Never means never. That word is used in some other places as well. Remember Peter over there in Matthew chapter 26 and verse 33? He said, Lord, there may be some others that'll forsake you, but what's true of me? I will never. What do you think Peter meant? Nothing is ever going to come up that will cause me to forsake you. Was he wrong?
Yes,
not very long after that time. So he was erroneous, but what he was trying to say was, I mean that never, ever, ever will something happen that will separate me from you. Then we find that other brother over in Luke chapter 15 and verse 29. Not the younger brother, the older brother. What did he say about his dad's commandments? He said, I have never done what? Transgressed your commandments. I've always done what you've wanted. Now, he might have been stretching the case there a little bit, but again, he's trying to make the point. I have always been obedient. Whatever you've asked of me, I've always done it. So same word there. Then you find Peter over in Acts chapter 10. That should clue in what's Acts chapter 10 discussing. Household of who?
Cornelius.
In Acts chapter 10, as Peter's having that vision, rise, Peter, kill and eat. What does Peter say? I never ate anything unclean. As Peter thinks back about his life, that's the point that he wants to emphasize. There was never a time, God, when I ate anything that was contrary to the Jewish dietary laws. Another little point here. When Luke talks about this crippled man in Acts chapter 14, this is not the first time that he's talked about someone who has this kind of problem. We've also seen this problem earlier. It's back in Acts chapter 3, verses 1 through 10. Different guy there, obviously, but same kind of problem. And we also found it back in Acts chapter 9, verses 33 through 35. I find that to be a little unusual because there were some differences between Jews and Gentiles. If you were a Jewish person and you had a son who was seriously disabled, Would you just throw him to the wolves, so to speak? What do we find back there in Acts chapter 3? Where does Peter meet the crippled guy? Peter and John. All right. The gate that is in what area? The temple. So there were people, even Lazarus, what did they do with him? Throw him to the wolves? Luke chapter 16. Where was he? He was carried where? All right. He was at least carried somewhere where he could get food every single day. So the Jews, they had at least some concern about people who had serious disabilities. If you were a Gentile, though, and you had serious disabilities, might you fare so well? Anybody know what the Gentiles did? Have a baby? Maybe you're looking for a son, you get a daughter, and you're a Gentile way back when. What do you do? Yeah, literally. You just throw the child over the city wall. Child dies because they don't get nourishment. Child dies because of wild animals. They were in many respects very, very brutal. One source said, and this is a good summation, Roman fathers sometimes, and I emphasize that, sometimes left disabled babies on the ground to be discarded on piles of trash or dung. Now, for us, the closest that we get to that is probably abortion in this country. But imagine a culture which says you are a deformed child, you have some obvious health issues, and we don't want you, we're just going to throw you on the trash heap. That's what it was like if you were looking at things from a Gentile perspective. And again, not everybody did that, but at least there certainly were some. That same source went on to say that the Jews had a much different view of people who had disabilities than the Romans. Those in ancient times with serious health issues faced many prejudices. We still have, to a certain degree, that same kind of problem today. Folks with serious health issues, sometimes they face serious prejudices, but it is not anything like what it used to be. If you had some serious health issues, it was just like, you know, we don't have time for you, no laws that would take care of that, you know, just go away, don't bother us, and if you do, we're okay with you being destroyed or put away or something else that's not very pleasant. Anything that you want to add or ask over what we've said thus far? Tim? Tim and then Bonnie.
There's, I don't know the number, but there's probably a lot of babies that have some kind of deformity, something wrong with them, that are aborted nowadays. We personally know of a person who aborted a baby that was Down syndrome, and she highly regrets it now. And this was at her husband's request, but and I don't know how he feels about it now, but I just know that they're not the only ones that do that. And so in that vein, we as people today are just as bad as those people were.
Yeah, in some respects worse. Because with all the medical technology that we have, we can go ahead and maybe not completely eliminate some things, but a child can be born, and we can do things that 2,000 years ago or beyond, it was just unthinkable that anything could be done.
Well, up there in Westland, where we lived before we moved here, I used to go to this Kroger store all the time, and they had a good, thing going there. They hired a lot of people that had, you know, mental problems, and they had several Down syndrome kids working there, and they were fun. I mean, they weren't like everybody else, but they, within that problem they had, they were functioning pretty well. They had a job, they could take care of themselves, they came to work by themselves, and you could talk to them, and you know, you really felt bad thinking about kids that were, you know, done away with because of that, because here are these kids that are actually working and taking care of themselves, and they're learning how to cope with life, you know.
One of the big problems in the medical field, and this has been around for a long time, is that technology doesn't always stay in tune with ethics. Medical technology, it just advances and advances and advances, and the medical ethics over here, they're oftentimes several years behind. And that becomes a problem if one gets out of balance. I know for us, my family faced that as well. Teresa, I don't know how many, it seemed like months she spent in the hospital before she gave birth to Beth. I mean, I just lost track after a while. But I do know that the docs were on her to go ahead and abort Beth. And they used a lot of experimental medicines just because she was so sick during that time. So she was good about staying the course, and everything seems to have turned out fine there. But we are at that point in time, and if things continue without much attention to ethics, we might get to the point where, if we're not already there, you want a baby boy with blue eyes and some other things, and if you don't get that, well, we're going to try again. And you just say, you know, well, that time was not quite what we desired, so we can continue to try, and we'll, you know, just keep aborting the fetus, quote-unquote, as the world looks at it, but killing the child, and eventually we'll get it right. And that's really sad, but when you outstrip technology with ethics, and that can be true in some other fields as well, but when those two things are not at least relatively close, it results in some serious problems. Bonnie will take you, and then maybe somebody else.
Well, there is a movement, you know, we say that life should be protected from conception to natural death, but there is a big movement out there, not only, you know, aborting a child that's not wanted or there's something wrong with it, but also doing away with the elderly when they get sick, of not giving them treatment. There's a big movement out there trying to achieve that. If we don't vote for people who are going to stand up for the sanctity of life, I don't know where we might be 100 years from now, 50 years, maybe even 25.
Yeah.
I hope I don't see it, but my grandchildren may.
Yeah. There again, you're back to medical ethics. And if you come to the conclusion that you are too expensive to insure, you're too expensive to care for, those kinds of things, you might start, maybe at the beginning, limiting health care. It used to be, on a lot of medical policies, $1 million as far as catastrophic. But you talk to some people, when they look at their, you know, I think I've met at least a few people who have hit the million-plus mark. But it's not anything for a person who has major surgery to start looking through the bills, and $100,000, that almost seems cheap. We've gone through $200,000, $300,000, $400,000. You look at accidents where somebody has to be choppered out, and then they have to go through 6 months. We think about Joe. Remember him? I don't remember how much time he was in the hospital, but the hospital bills, and he did not, to my recollection, give me a number. But he was in the hospital for several months, if not at least a year. And when you start looking at intensive care as far as those bills and everything that they're doing, the specialists that they bring in, some of the cancer treatments that people go through, you really want the gold-plated insurance policy if you're going to get decent care, because it adds up in a hurry. Stan, I thought there was another hand there.
I think that the problem is a lot worse than what we think, too, because we talk about it here, and because we're on that subject, we bring it up. But there are a tremendous number of people out there who've had issues or have issues right now that you don't even know about. And so the fact that we, in a lot of cases, we just sit here and we think, well, it's never going to happen to me, or it's not a part of my life, or whatever, and yet really it is. I know it kind of hits home to me, especially when we're talking about this crippled man, because our daughter was, and we had to have medical attention to get her feet straightened back out. You never know it today, and we rarely talk about it, don't have reason to, but there are a lot of those cases, and we just need to be more cognizant.
We do, and things have changed so much where, as I mentioned earlier, you may have someone who's born with certain problems. You think about poor teeth. You can get braces. There have been some people who have had horrible teeth, but the braces straightened out the teeth, and you would never know X number of years down the line that a person really had some problems with teeth in the earlier years. Orthodontist was able to go in, or someone else, and straighten those up, and everything works out great. So we can't fix every problem, but compared to the past, we can do many, many things that are really good, but there's always a cost. And at some point, society may say, no more, or you're going to have to wait so long, you're dead, by the time your name and number finally come up for treatment. Are we done? Oh, I'm sorry, Ray, and then Betty. Yeah, sure. There's another good example.
Before Miles was born, the doctor recommended that they abort him because of his problem. the doctor could not treat him for what his problem mm-hmm. was. 3 weeks later, the Food and Drug Administration authorized inflammatory surgery, whatever. That's not the right word. But the same doctor that wanted to abort him, delivered him, but before delivering him, he done surgery on him, mm-hmm. and then he delivered him 8 weeks later. He's almost 26 now. And that's a good example of being rushing to this abortion too quickly.
Yeah, it is. And you can just go down the list as far as example. And he's still struggling with some things, but still, he did reach adulthood, and when you talk to him, he is a functioning adult.
Surgeries that had ever been done for that on a child that was still in the womb. And yet they still say it's nothing but a fetus, they won't afford it, but yet you're willing to operate on it? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just the contradiction of the world and what they refuse that it's so confusing for the young people anymore, I think, and just
it is. When you and they're mixed up. You know, as Isaiah talked about, I think it's Isaiah chapter 5 about verse 20, they call evil good, good evil. If it's an animal, oftentimes they'll pull out all the stops.
Oh, yeah.
We have this animal, it's got this problem, and it's never going to be right, but still, you know, we've got to save, you know, the porcupine or whatever that might be. And you're thinking, why here? Man is made in the image of God, the porcupine isn't, why not here? But you start letting secular ethics take over and you abandon God and focus on his word and you are going to get fouled up big time. And we see that. I mean, there's example after example. Virginia.
Do you think it's wrong? I mean, if you have something wrong with you, if you're, say, my age.
Okay.
And you're in the hospital.
42? All right.
And if you're in a hospital and they want to put you on life preserver or whatever, and they keep you alive, do you think that is wrong? If you don't want it, do you think that is wrong?
If you want the simple answer, no. All die. Hebrews 9:27. Now, you might be able to artificially extend life, but all die. And that's
just to keep somebody
sure.
alive, just to have them living. To me, that is.
Yeah. You're not trying to prematurely end life.
No.
But you are recognizing that biblical fact that life does end.
Yeah.
And you have come to the end after you have reached that point in time where the body wants to shut down. And there are some other considerations there. You might have a person who wants to artificially extend life, and you need to be careful with this argument, but for this specific matter, it could be looked at as a matter of stewardship. It's going to oppose some unnecessary medical bills, maybe on family, maybe on some others. It's going to draw away some resources. So you don't want, God is the giver of life, he also has responsibility when it comes to the end of life. So you don't want to take that life prematurely, as in the case of suicide, but there's also no obligation to artificially extend our existence. Is that it? Okay. Let's go back and look at that word impotent. That's a word which has an alpha privative, and that simply means that it's like some of our words. You think about happy. You want to make unhappy that word, what do you do? Well, you put an un in front of it. Or you could do the same thing with just. This is a just judge. This is an unjust judge. Now, the word impotent is the Greek word for power. This guy had power in his feet. Well, they add an A to it, just like theist. You add A to it and becomes an atheist. And they Luke took that word for power, added that un, if you will, or that A in front of it. And that tells us that he did not have power in his feet. That same word is used in Hebrews chapter 6 and verse 18. Without faith, it is what? It is impossible. Can't please God if we're not willing to have faith. So again, Luke reminds us that this fellow had never walked. The problem had been from birth. I think you can add one other quick point here. And unlike modern faith healers, there's no question that this guy had a serious health problem. He looked like he was a hopeless case. All right, Acts chapter 14, 9 and 10. The same, that guy who was impotent in his feet, heard Paul speaking, who fastening his eyes upon him and seeing that he had the faith to be made whole, said with a loud voice, "Stand upright on thy feet." And he leaped up and walked. Luke, on this occasion, did not tell us where Paul was teaching. Generally, as we've seen from Paul, when he goes into a new town, where's he head? All right, he goes over to the Jewish synagogue and starts with them. Now, we have seen from the last few classes that Paul said, I'm also going to be turning to some Gentiles because the Jews were not always very receptive. But here, because Luke does not mention a Jewish synagogue, I'm kind of thinking that at this place there may not have been one. We have Timothy a little bit later. He was from a Jewish background, so can't say that for sure. But if that is true, and because the streets were very narrow in ancient times, I think it's likely that Paul was possibly doing some open-air preaching. Anybody ever been in a city where they had open-air preaching? Maybe some guy just down the street? Where was that, Ray?
San Diego.
Okay, so California may have some of that. Anybody else? Okay, so sometimes that was done in earlier years, Stacy?
Yeah, we've had revivals down there in Arkansas and Baldwin outside.
Okay, Arkansas. I saw it in San Antonio, Texas, one time. Had just the street preacher out there. I'm not sure how many people were listening, but at least for the people who passed by, he was trying to communicate something as far as a Bible message. So when you think about ancient people, could have been open-air preaching, but as we're going to see, this community also had a temple. And what have we seen from our other studies about temples? People would go there to worship. Anything else? All right. A lot of stuff is taking place in the temple area. You might have places where they will transact some money transactions. You can change over your money. There might be a marketplace there. Big place for people to come and greet. Today we still have some places like that. It's kind of the gathering place. Everybody wants to come there and be there. So that would have made sense for Paul to go sometimes to the temple area. So you have this crippled man, verse 8, he hears Paul speaking. Continued action there. He's continuing to listen. And Luke also makes it clear that Paul took note of this man. We've seen this word fastened. Some other translations might have a different word, but that's Paul, fastens his eyes upon him. Now that's a word that you want to define because sometimes I think people can think that that was some type of hypnotizing stare. Paul was giving him the evil eye. What you looking at? That's not what's going on here. He's looking at this guy with seriousness. Paul is focused on him. There is single-mindedness. So just as you might be having a conversation in a group, you might be looking straight at the person and thinking, I'm looking at you. I'm focused on you. I'm thinking about you specifically. Paul not only has that focus on the fella, he said that Paul knew that this guy had faith. We're going to come back to that in a little bit. What's said about the man's faith? This guy had faith to be made whole, or had the faith to be healed or cured. So the handicapped man, he believed what Paul was saying, and he did not hesitate to act. What kind of voice does Paul use? Luke says he spoke with a loud voice. And with that loud voice, what was the command? I want you to stand. You stand upright on your feet, and the man did as he was told. What's the text say? After Paul said those words, what occurred? He leaps up, and then what else takes place? He begins to walk, and that walking is expressed with the imperfect tense. It was continuing action. Now, here's what I found that was a little interesting. The word upright comes from the original word orthos. So you can kind of see, I think, how with time, orthopedic, how that word has evolved, if you will, and how we even sometimes use part of that word today. Why do you think Paul might have used a loud voice? Why do we use a loud voice today?
reach as many people as possible.
All right, we want to get attention. We want to reach as many people as possible. If you are going to perform a miracle, and not just a miracle, but you're going to perform a miracle on this guy who has never walked, and especially throughout there, the temple area, this guy was probably well known to the people who are around there. What do you want?
As many people as possible.
All right. You're going to start sending up the fireworks, right? What do you want? You send up the first one, get some attention. And once everybody's looking over in that direction, then you're ready to launch the rest of them. So likely for attention-getting purposes, Paul wanted the people to know that his words were more than words. And certainly the leaping up of the guy also is probably a little attention-getting. Now here's a little point. Let's go back to the point that I was mentioning earlier. I want to call your attention to that. People say, well, if they're a Pentecostal, people say you have to have faith to be healed. Do you have faith? Is that what we find here in Acts chapter 14? Yeah, isn't that interesting? Seeing, understanding, knowing that this guy had faith. Here is a fellow with the power of the Holy Spirit, and he didn't have to ask, do you have faith? He knew. He was able to determine that. Wouldn't that be interesting to ask one of the Pentecostal faith healers today? You can tell. Why have you been asking? That's what we find in the Bible. Acts chapter 14, verses 9 and 10. So, if someone wants to head to the book of Acts, specifically Acts chapter 14, this is not a very good passage for them. Two, and we've made this point at different times over the years, if you want to talk about faith, what about the young child who has been born with this kind of deformity? Why not go and head up to the infant ward at the local hospital and find the children who have been born with a body that is not what they wanted it to be and will cause them some problems later in life? Heal the people who are crippled, disable the people with terminal diseases. Now, here's something interesting that you may not have noticed, and I'm going to give you the references. You can find these if you want to go back to Acts chapter 3. But in both cases, you have a healing back in Acts 3, you have this healing in Acts chapter 14. In both cases, the guys have not only been handicapped or disabled, but they've been disabled from when? From birth. That's interesting. Then you have Acts 3, 4, Acts 14, verse 9, that both Peter and Paul are looking at these disabled people before the healing occurs. And then after the healing occurs, Acts 3, 8, and Acts chapter 14, verse 10, you have them leaping, and they're able to walk. And then you have both healings, what we, as indicated from Acts chapter 14, they both seem to be in the vicinity of a temple. Acts 3 says that for sure, and we also get that hint from Acts chapter 14 and verse 13. You also have both healings mentioned in conjunction with faith. Going back to Acts chapter 3, you can see that in verse 16, and then also from Acts chapter 14 and verse 19. And then we haven't gotten quite this far yet, but in Acts 14, 15, where we won't probably get to today, you combine that with Acts chapter 3 and verse 12, you find that Peter and John, they rejected human praise for the miracle. Paul's going to do the same thing. I'm not sure why Luke listed all those parallels, but I've got a suspicion. Anybody want to take a guess why? Peter, Paul, Peter, Paul, Peter, Paul, Peter, Paul. Again and again. Peter did this, Paul did this. Straight down the line, probably at least five or six different parallels. Why do that?
So that everybody will know that Paul is legitimate.
I think that's probably right. You have Peter, he sort of takes the stage, front stage, in Acts chapter 2 through Acts chapter 10. He's the featured speaker in Acts chapter 2, featured speaker with the Gentiles in Acts chapter 10. And Paul kind of comes on the scene, and it's kind of like, well, you or Johnny come lately. If he can do all the same kinds of things that Peter can, guess what? He is of equal rank, equal stature. He is no less an apostle of Peter or anyone else, for that matter. So you have the miracles by these guys, they were instant, they were complete, no therapy, no recovery time was necessary. Anything that you want to discuss before we look at Acts chapter 14, 11, and 13? Stan.
I find this interesting, and we've talked about this sort of thing before when we came to Christ and his healing, how he was so powerful, had so much power that anything could have happened had he not been specific. And Paul did the same thing in this particular case. He says, stand on your feet. Now, it would seem strange to think that the guy might have jumped up and walked on his hands, but he could have, he might have,
Yeah.
But Paul was very specific about how he tended to the man.
And that's true. I mean, when you think about, and some of the older preachers talked about this quite often, that Jesus said, Lazarus, come forth. Had Jesus not said that, I'm not sure that I'd word it quite that way. Because if the Lord intended for Lazarus to come forth and he didn't specify Lazarus's name, I'm pretty sure that it would have been just Lazarus. But had he wanted them to all come forth, could that have happened?
Sure.
You've been baptized in the Holy Spirit and you want to heal all the crippled people in the town. Could you speak the word? No. I have no reason to not believe that that is how that would have worked. But they were specific, perhaps more because they wanted to draw attention to that man and just say, this is the focus of the miracle. Because if you're dealing with everybody, they might say, well, he was taken care of over here and she was taken care of over here for different reasons. But they made it clear that this was to confirm the word, and it did an excellent job. Tim?
I think that one of the reasons the apostles oftentimes spoke with a loud voice was because they were speaking for God. And they wanted all who could hear them to understand that they were speaking with authority.
That's a great point to bring out as well. When you have the person who doesn't say something very, very loudly, what are you thinking about the guy? He's probably not very confident. He doesn't feel like he's got much assurance in either what he's saying or his power. They're going to sort of shrink back and hide in a corner. But if you've got a guy who is willing to look you in the eye and say, this is the way it is, this is what I'm teaching, I'm going to show you this miracle, well, chances are he feels at least like he can back it up, and very likely he can.
And when they speak like that, it stirs emotions in you.
It does. You feel some degree of confidence. Now, if the guy can't produce, the fellow says, I'm going to show you the best magic trick in the world. Well, and then he fouls it up or says, well, you know, I was just kidding. I mean, then you're kind of disappointed. But when somebody says that, you are expecting something that's going to be really great.
If someone's been lame from their youth, I could see that if they're told to get up, that they would be apprehensive. They might crawl up and get on their knees and then kind of maybe stand up on their knees and then maybe kind of get up. But if you say, stand upright on your feet, then that tells you, skip all that nervousness and just go straight to being upright.
Yeah, and I think you have to go back there to the faith that Paul saw in this guy. Whatever he was saying was so convincing, it was like, I believe that you are a spokesman from God. So if you give me the word, this is what's going to take place. So that's commendable on the part of this man. And he didn't, you know, think, well, who's going to give me a hand? Now, back in Acts chapter 3, you've got Peter and John. They're willing to kind of give him a hand. But here, the guy just leaps up and is ready to go. So it makes you think a little bit about times where at thy word, when they're out there in the fishing boat, you give us the word, you tell us to put the net down, and we believe it's going to happen. That's a great lesson for us. When God has made a promise in his word, well, maybe, possibly, we'll just kind of check that out and wait and see. No. If God has said it, that's the final word.
This is maybe a minor thing, but and he walked, and he had never walked before. He had never been upright before. Anybody that has had an operation or been in an accident or had a knee replacement or a broken foot or whatever, you're off your feet, you're not walking, or you're walking with assistance. To have never walked, never stood upright, and leaped up, then there's hypotension of your blood pressure and dizziness. I mean, the man had nothing like that. He was able to walk when he had, you know, you think of a small child learning how to walk and their balance and all the stuff that goes with that.
And now you're an adult. You got all that extra weight.
And you don't, and had never stood on your feet and stood upright. Anyway, I just thought about that.
That's a good reminder about the completeness or fullness of God's miracles. You would say, well, if you know, you get some help up and he's going to steady you for a couple minutes and then you're able to start walking, that would be magnificent.
Right.
But when God cured people, I don't know if we could say that there was also a mental aspect to it as well, that you're not going to have
fear of,
well, that could be too.
Falling or...
Yeah, you are good to go. But have the faith, and that's where a lot of people struggle, even now. Well, God, you said, but... And when you start kicking in the butts, that's where the issue is. Are we done? Okay. Let's at least start in Acts 14, 11 to 13. And when the multitude saw what Paul had done, they lifted up their voice, saying in the speech of Lycaonia, "The gods are come down to us in the likeness of men." And they called Barnabas Jupiter and Paul Mercury, because he was the chief speaker. And the priests of Jupiter, whose temple was before the city, brought oxen and garlands under the gates, and would have done sacrifice with the multitudes. We've seen before some of the Jews, as you go back there to verse 7, they saw the miracles, and even though they could not explain them away, they did not want to believe them. They rejected them. And now they have this one to contend with. You've got the man who had never walked. He impotent from his mother's womb, and he, as Marcia said, is instantly, he's fully cured. And how excited were the people? This got them worked up. They're thinking, the gods have come down to us. Now, here's a little point. I don't think we're going to have time to fully develop this, so we'll let you munch on this for a week. Luke says that they spoke in what language? Yes. Why make that point? Well, maybe. Anything else?
The apostles understood what they were saying too.
Maybe. Anything else? Now we're getting closer. It was because of where they were. This was their natural language. Maybe the point is this, and there's a little bit more to it that we're not going to be able to get to today. You have somebody who, we see this in our day and time. With Teresa's family, we see it, and with the Spanish that we have in the community, we see it as well. Here's a person, they're talking English, but it's not their native language. Their native language is Spanish. And we're having a nice conversation, and then all of a sudden they get excited, and they're going to talk real fast. So what do? They revert back to their native language. All of a sudden they start talking in, you know, Japanese, Chinese, they start talking in Spanish. Why do that? I mean, that's what they grew up with. So with that enthusiasm, they revert back to that native language. When you look at the excitement that was generated here, I think that is the point, that Paul was probably speaking Greek, and they understood that, but Greek was not their native language. So when they see this, they are so enthused, they start talking about how wonderful it was. They revert back to the Lycaonian dialect.
When you speak of another language than your own native language, you have to process.
Yes.
And translate it into the other language. So I think that's when they get excited, they don't take the time to do that processing.
Yeah.
And so they revert back to the native language.
And for some cases, that can be helpful. You want people to really think about something. And Greek was the ideal language to communicate the gospel in. So as Paul is going and talking about Christianity, that would have been the ideal language to talk about. I'm going to stop it there, because sure enough, if we go a little further, it's going to get complicated.